Thank you. Yes, I'm delighted to be here. It's always great to come down. Sorry to bring the rain, but that's life. I'm used to it, and I like it. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about mostly about this second paper here that came out just 6 months ago or so. Maybe a little bit of comments about the work in progress, doing with the same characters, and then you'll see some bits that I took from this earlier paper. That was with a slightly different set of authors. Okay, well, I hardly need to do motivation, but it does seem like one has to remind ourselves that dark matter exists. At least it exists with respect to gravitational interactions. And of course, we have overwhelming evidence from CMB and galaxies, clusters, baryonic-acoustic oscillations, and so forth. We've looked for it through scattering off of matter for decades and not found it. And this is sort of the standard canonical plot that one often sees. Of course, this is quite old now. This was actually from the snowmass days of the 2013. So the limits have, of course, marched down by a couple of orders of magnitude in the meantime since then. But this gives you an idea of the large number of searches that have been going on for a long time and sort of the range by which they're able to probe, at least the searches near the weak scale. Now, of course, there's lots of searches people are thinking about, both north of 10 TeV and also way south of 1 GeV. Okay? But the focus for this today, what I'm going to be doing, will end up being within sort of this range broadly. Just to orient everyone, if you are not already and immediately familiar, since I will present some results in this plane of the WIMP nucleon cross-section, of course, this is the nucleon, this is the per-nucleon cross-section defined in this particular way, such that if you had a cross-section that was, for example, by Higgs exchange, then you would have there's a relative a to the fourth difference between the effective interaction with the nucleon and the effective interaction with the nucleus. Okay, due to the ratios of the reduced mass and the a squared enhancement, the coherence off the nucleus. Okay, so we haven't seen it, and we're at the stage where, right, if it were actually a WIMP with a true weak interaction, it would have sat even above the plot, right, 10 to the minus 38 or so centimeters squared. And of course, if we actually have Higgs, if the Higgs is the mediator doing the exchange, you know, if it was an order one, Yukawa, and all other things being equal, you should be sitting sort of around 10 to the minus 43, 44 or so, you know, centimeters squared. And that's also a large chunk of this has been ruled out, at least down to the threshold under which the detectors are able to measure. Right. So, if dark matter interacts inelastically, which is to say that the leading interaction is dark matter, chi1 comes in, interacts with a nucleus, and excites to some excited state that I'm calling chi2, then this can weaken or evade the direct detection bound simply because there's not enough energy of a non-relativistic WIMP nearby us to have actually been seen through this process. So the purpose of the talk is to look for new ways to try to find this process in cases where the direct detection is not able to be sensitive or is less sensitive than what you can do with these new techniques. So that's the purpose. And for those of you who fade out sometime during the talk, here's the summary of what we're going to do. We'll use the entire Earth as a detector. Dark matter comes in, does some sort of scattering. There's a hint as to what it's going to scatter off of, at least for part of the talk. And chi2 flies off, it decays into a photon, and we're going to look for the photon. That's the purpose of this. Okay. All right. Well, to get into all of this, I need to do a quick review of inelastic dark matter. Some of you may be familiar, may not. Let me tell you a few things about it so it gives you some idea of what I'm doing. Okay, so inelastic dark matter goes back a long ways. There's early papers by Hahn Hempfling, Hall, Moroi, Mariyama, but I think it was widely popularized by Dave Tucker Smith and Neil Moyner, back in the early 2000s, because they had an idea of using inelastic dark matter to try to explain the Dhamma annual modulation. And that created its own story, which went on for many, many years. And I would say, despite, you know, really exceptional model building effort, we're pretty much at the stage where you can't explain Dhamma and still be consistent with other bounds. I think that's a fair statement. Okay. Certainly you can't do it with inelastic dark matter, as I'm going to be presenting it today.
But why it would be inelastic? I mean, if there is inelastic, it would be elastic as well. Well,
so the issue of how big the elastic cross-section is in it with or in addition to the inelastic is an interesting story. I'll have the odd comment about it here and there, but it's model dependent, right, as to how big it is.
There should be special reason why it would be dominant inelastic rather than elastic, right?
Sure, sure, and there are great reasons for that. The purpose of my talk, though, is not to go into all of that, and I can go at it for hours about various model building where you can do that, but the simplest example is simply you take a Dirac fermion and you just split it by a Majorana mass. And once you do that, the size of the splitting is the splitting we're talking about, and then the lightest state, because it's being Majorana, it doesn't have vector interactions with matter. But if the splitting is such that there is a vector mediator, then you can imagine a scenario where the inelastic scattering is dominant, but the elastic scattering is suppressed. Right. Okay, good. All right, so the background for this is dark matter has an excited state with a very small splitting. And by small, let's be precise, I mean something that is up to the highest, sort of roughly the highest kinetic energy that a WIMP could have in lab frame coming in and hitting the nucleus. Okay, so this is, you know, roughly speaking, 1/2 mu v squared. Okay, so mu is the reduced mass of the dark matter in nucleus system, and v is, of course, the lab frame velocity. This is just an assumption, right? The assumption is the dark sector consists of dark matter, there is an excited state, and they're split by an amount. And then you can model build all day long trying to realize how these things come about. I'm going to take this as the assumption and then move forward. Okay.
Question?
Yep.
Does it matter that the delta is roughly half a MeV?
It does. Yes, it does. It does matter. Mm-hmm. But are you, well,
it does.
Oh, yeah, I mean, so it does, but for probably not for the reason you're thinking.
So obviously, if delta m is much smaller than, you know, this quantity, which is roughly, as you say, the kinetic energy of dark matter around the galaxy, then, you know, you're not going to have this channel.
If the splitting is larger than this, you will not have this. Correct.
It's much smaller.
If it's much smaller, then you can still inelastically scatter.
But if it's much smaller than that, yeah. Okay. So this is, okay.
Sorry, so
it's only, okay. No, it's okay, fine.
But it's also close to the mass of electron, right?
It is, so that's right.
That's what I was asking.
So the relevant thing is, and this is why I already gave the hint slide of the right, the signal we will look for is the decay of chi 2 to chi 1 and a photon. If it had been above 2 times the mass of the electron, then of course you could go into pairs of electrons. But you can't because of the fact that it just happens to be for our velocities in our galaxy and for the most massive elements that the Earth is made of, this is the number.
Yeah,
so that's a coincidence.
You'll be assuming dark matter mass is below, let's say, the mass of silicon or whatever.
On the contrary, it will be actually above.
Oh, above. Oh, yes, this is the lighter one. Okay,
precisely. Okay. It'll be above. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in fact, to that end, let's go to kinematics. Okay. So the assumption of inelastic dark matter is that the scattering is dominated by the inelastic process. And if it does go through this, then you can go into the parameter space of the region to understand where scattering is possible and where it's not. So the key thing to this, of course, is you have to have enough kinetic energy to be able to do the excitation, which means there's a minimum velocity to scatter. And the minimum velocity just scales as, no surprise, the inelastic splitting and divided by the reduced mass square root, okay, this expression. So for this particular case here, there's a 1 TeV candidate, delta of 100 keV. The space in the recoil energy and lab frame velocity that is viable to scatter is inside here, inside this region. So the most likely recoil energy to see for inelastic is not at the lowest recoil energies, but is in fact roughly at the scale of delta. When ER is of order delta, that's where you would get the most number of events, all other things considered equal. Crucially, there's a gap in ER here. I'll come to that in a moment. Heavy dark matter maximizes the scattering, and that's simply because the Vmin goes as 1 over the reduced mass. So, reduced mass, if you go to heavy dark matter, this gets dominated by the nucleus. The reduced mass gets dominated by the nucleus, and so it basically maxes out to this value, and then you get one of these sort of envelopes within the VER space that you have viable scattering. If you go to light dark matter, then the reduced mass light relative to the nucleus, then of course this gets dominated by this lighter dark matter mass here, and you get a much reduced parameter space that you can scatter. So you can already tell that the parameter space that I'm going to be interested in is when dark matter is heavier than the mass of the nucleus. Okay. That it's inelastically scattering off of. You also, in general, would like heavy elements because the heavier the element, the smaller the Vmin by which you can scatter, and so therefore the more of the velocity distribution you can sample. Okay, and so and that's again just how it goes. Inelastic dark matter is sensitive to the tail of the velocity distribution because if I take the same plot and I look at the range in Vmin ER space, and then just plot that with respect to the velocity, the typical Maxwellian with a cutoff velocity distribution that you would expect in Earth frame, you see that, okay, so if I'm looking at V velocities of 400 or 500 kilometers per second, then this is sampling this part of the tail. As I go further out, of course, I'm down on the exponential. And of course, this is also one of the places where you can intuitively see that the annual modulation becomes much larger for inelastic dark matter precisely because you magnify these effects. Okay. There's also nuclear structure effects, but I only want to make one quick comment about this. Details I'm happy to do afterward, but for example, if you take a particular element that you might be interested in inelastically scattering off of, like xenon, forget about the three curves. This is work relating to whether Helm works or whether you should do real shell model nuclear physics calculations. But in any case, they all have the same basic property that there are regions within the nuclear recoil form factor that you will sample, and which one is actually most important may depend, you know, sort of sensitively on where you are in the ER space. So for some regions, you may actually want to go to even higher recoil energies to maximize the rate. And again, it just depends on the details. What inelastic splitting do you have? What detector are you using? What isotopes are there? And so forth. So in 2006, when we did this first paper, we were interested in just trying to understand what are the bounds in the inelastic parameter space. And in 2016, I said the wrong date. Sorry. 2016, we were just in what are the bounds. And this is what we got. So at the time, the bounds, as you might expect, were best from lux. Obviously, in the limit that the inelasticity is small, then the nuclear recoil is behaving basically like an elastic candidate. And so this will asymptote to the elastic scattering cross-section. But as you dial up the inelasticity, the splitting, then of course the bound that you get rapidly goes away. And once you got to an inelastic splitting of something like 150 or so keV, 150, 180 or so, then there was no bound from lux. Okay. The reason for that is because the data that they analyzed, the data that lux analyzed, went from sort of roughly 1 keV to 20-ish or so keV. They did not analyze data above that. They had some data going up a little bit above 20, maybe 30, 40, 50 or so keV, but then it sort of maxed out. And the reason for this is because of how lux calibrated their detector. And they chose a particular neutron source that was capable of calibrating their detector up to tens of keV, but not beyond that. So they effectively had a limit to how far they could probe their data. And that made sense to them because for elastic scattering dark matter, you maximize the signal by lowering the threshold and looking only at the low energy ER. So it made sense to do it for elastic scattering, but it actually harms you for your ability to probe inelastic scattering. PICO and CREST did not have really any upper bound. CREST had some nominal upper bound of 120 keV, but PICO actually could go all the way up to an NeV and be sensitive to recoils. And they didn't reject anything. They did not, there was no, they calibrated all the way to that stage because of the different nature of the technology.
So for Lux, is it a calibration issue or the fact that they just simply didn't record things above 18.6 keV?
So they recorded they recorded above, and they have, you can actually see the data up to sort of 30 to 40 or so keV. And then, but once you get past 50 or so, they don't have a calibration. Lux doesn't.
But I maybe missed, what is the implant, can I say?
I'm still on this slide. Yeah. This side, I'm going to go to that side in a second, yeah.
One can in principle do the calibration after the fact, though, with, I don't know, cosmics or some other sources, right?
Correct. So you could try, or the alternative is, and as I'll show you in a moment, the other Xenon collaboration, Xenon 100 at the time, and Panda X used americium, I believe. I think that's the name of it, that has much higher energy neutrons, so it can calibrate all the way up to about 300, 400 keV. Okay, so they could do the same thing. They chose not to for their own reasons. They actually wanted basically better calibration at lower energies, lower recoil energies, because that's where they thought they're going to get the most bang for the buck. Okay. PICO could, or actually did have at the time, the best bounds going up. And so what we had sort of, what we had pointed out in this paper was that if you extended the recoil energies, if you did it exactly as you say, if you recalibrated or and then probed this data going up to much higher energies, then you'd be able to actually significantly push this over by, you know, a factor of two or so in delta, and that's parameter space, that should be probed. It's important in some level because the place where these lines are crossing happens to be along this dotted line, which is roughly the Z cross section, right? So this is exactly where a normal standard WIMP with Z exchange is going to work, 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared. So PICO is doing the best for that type of model, and Lux could push and go past it if they wanted to. By 2017, Panda X and Xenon 100 did do this. This is the plot from Panda X. This is our sort of regurgitation of Xenon 100's result, but fine, okay. And effectively, they were able to push out to sort of 250, 280 or so keV. As a result of analyzing up to higher energy. So Xenon 100 could do this easily because they already had a calibration. And Lux, to my knowledge, never has done this later, as far as I know. Okay. So my only model slide. So yeah, that's my daughter a while ago, some years ago, playing with models, model trains. And as sort of I'm indicating by this, yeah, you can play with it all you want all day long, but really we want to eventually get the new signal. So I don't want to go into this in great detail. But if you want to know, the sort of the model in the back of my mind is often the narrowly split Higgsino. So this is a version where the normal Higgsino, if it were a absolutely pure Higgsino, would have a full strength weak scale interaction because you have a Dirac fermion sitting there. And the correct abundance to make this work is about 1 TeV, 1.1 TeV. Okay. Higgsinos, of course, also have Wino and Beno partners to them. And if their masses are sufficiently heavy, then you can make this splitting small. If you want to get to the range we're talking about, there has to be a splitting of 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 3-ish times above the mass of the Higgsino, okay? Because it's scaling like mz squared over the Beano or Ueno mass. Okay, that's the scaling. One power, it's dimension 5. So Higgsinos are a simple example where you can imagine that this cross-section is in fact order 10 to the minus 39. So it's actually this dotted line that I'm showing on these plots. Well, the spin-independent cross-section is actually much suppressed. And it's suppressed for a number of reasons, or a few reasons. One is, of course, it's loop-suppressed, as we know, but also the effective cross-section, which involves, say, W exchange or doing a box with W's and a Higgs exchange going through, is twist 2, which means it has a further suppression of momenta. So that's what forces this to be small, 10 to the minus 47 or smaller. Then it also happens to be that the Higgs exchange diagram and the W exchange diagram have opposite signs, a famous controversy for many years. But that's been settled, and now we know that they actually destructively cancel almost exactly where the Higgs mass is at 125. So this cross-section is at least below 10 to the minus 47 and maybe much, much below that. Either way, you're not going to see it in elastic scattering. So the idea that you could have an inelastic process that dominates and an elastic one that is suppressed is actually sort of automatically realized in this scenario. There are other cases you can do. Another one is magnetic inelastic. And this is, in fact, one of the first instances in which people thought about looking for a photon signal, and it's called luminous dark matter by Peter, Sergeant, and Brian, I think, back many, many years ago. Alas, their idea, trying to explain DAMA, it's dead. That was dead pretty quickly after it came out because of direct detection bounds. There was another version of this a few years later by Neil and Maxim Pospilov called two-step. Also an interesting thing, has some relationship to what we're doing, also now dead, okay, because of direct detection bounds. However, you can generalize this to a general cross-section in delta, and this actually becomes really interesting. And this is actually the work that's in preparation, is looking at magnetic and elastic.
So here the coupling is the dark matter,
and
what is it?
In magnetic inelastic, this is this. Yes, that's right. It's chi 1, chi 2, sigma mu nu, f mu nu. Yeah, dimension 5. Okay. So for the remainder, I'm going to take that the cross section, the inelastic cross section, is arbitrary and delta is arbitrary. But of course, models will map into that space, and not necessarily populate the whole region. Okay, how to get excited?
I mean, these models, they're looking at, you know, they have this coupling with which, you know, you do this inelastic scattering and everything also takes care of, like, dark matter production in the universe, or...
You mean getting the right abundance?
Yeah.
Right, so they're...
Assuming, you know, this is comes out of the...
So, right, so again, Higgsinos get the right abundance when the mass is 1.1 TeV.
Right.
And that's, again, because...
Sure. I mean, I agree in the first model you were discussing about.
Correct. You mean for magnetic inelastics in particular. There, I actually don't even know what the abundance is off the top of my head, but roughly, you know, the scale that suppresses that, if it gets too suppressed, then you'll overpopulate, and you'll have to find a new mechanism to get the abundance. Okay. Good. So, now to the signal, or at least the beginnings of it. So what we wanted to do was to look for the possibility that dark matter would come in, it would inelastically scatter, not in a detector, but in the earth or rock around or further away from the detector, excite to this excited state, which lives for a period of time or a length, decays to a photon, and it's the decay into the photon that we want to search for in some detector that's sensitive to photons. And then, of course, the dark matter.
Then it stopped to be dark matter.
Say what?
Then it stopped to be called dark matter.
The chi 1, though.
Dark is, by definition, the one which doesn't emit light.
Not for inelastic, right? So.
No, I mean, because it's kind of, the name itself is kind of oxymoron, right? Dark matter, is that why you would say?
It's not as dark as you think. That's right.
Not enough dark.
Okay, so what I want to do now is sort of walk through the mechanics of how this is going to go. And it has a whole number of little intrigue, little amusements along the way. I'll tell you some of the bits. If you're interested in more, you find me, no problem. But clearly what we need to do then is to make this sort of scenario go. You can already tell the steps along the way. We need to understand what you can scatter off of, how much of it is there, what are these decay lengths typically. This decay process, for example, how often is this occurring versus some other decay? What kind of detector is here, and how are you going to make that go? Okay, and ultimately, how are you going to separate the photons that you're seeing from this from random background photons you might get from radioactive decay? So the first thing is, what is the Earth made of? So you go to Wikipedia, and it tells you what the Earth is made of. And here are the elements. Now this is, I think, from, this is geology. So they have abundance and wonderful units of atoms of element per 10 to the 6 atoms of silicon. Okay, that's what they decided to do. Silicon, of course, is one of the highest, well, 10 to the 6 in this unit. You know, it is sort of an amusing plot, but fine, okay. There, you know, lots of deep physics in terms of where all of the elements come from. Nevertheless, for our purpose, we just need to know, we need to identify the ones that may be relevant for inelastic scattering. So if you're going to very large delta, then you're interested in heavy elements. The heaviest element, of course, is uranium, and it has some abundance down here, 10 to the 1 per 10 to the 6 of silicon, then thorium, then lead, and lead is pretty good because you can see relative to just about anything else here, if you're high up in Z number, lead is really dominating. So lead is a good element. So it's Z number of 82, the average A is about 207. Its abundance in the Earth is roughly averaged over the Earth, 10 to the minus 5 grams per gram. This is the standard units. And there's a number of different isotopes that you get, that you populate from radioactive decay, okay, uranium and thorium and so forth. Amusingly, the ratios of these elements was in fact the first way in which the Earth's age was measured in 1956 to 4.55 gigayears, which is kind of cool, right? You go and measure these things and take the ratios, look at, you know, all right, anyway. That, I found that really amusing. There is, however, some depth dependence of the elements. This, again, you know, and to what extent these numbers are known and to what accuracy is something that is of some debate. At least it's, shall we say, it's a debate among us physicists on the collaboration as well as the geologists who try to tell us these numbers. But for example, the abundance of lead in the crust is markedly higher than the abundance in the mantle by a factor of 35 or so. And okay, that's sort of an amusement. Once I was in some random faculty meeting with different people of in different professions, including a geologist, and something came up about saying something about what research you're working on. And I said, blah, blah, blah. And I said them something about, oh yeah, dark matter scattering off elements in the Earth. And by the way, do you know why this is true? And then, and they're like, were you surprised at this? And the geologist was like, oh yes, well, it's this thing, that is convection, blah, 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 and it seemed intuitive to him.
But how long this excited state lives? Because if it's kind of short living now, then internal doesn't matter, right?
Indeed. Good point. We're getting there. Next slide, next two slides. Let's just wait. So, all right, so the abundances, here we are, different core, mantle, crust, and they vary a little bit. Lead, iron, iron isn't varying very much. You know, it's within a factor of 2, okay, as you go between the different places. Okay, the decay. If you inelastically scatter like hexenos through a Z exchange, then of course you can do the inverse process of weak decay of chi2 to chi1 and emit off neutrinos. And this goes to this issue of whether the splitting is critical. If the splitting is below 2 times the electron mass, significantly below that. Oh, awesome. No, that's fine. I feel like I should be talking with the piano. I don't think I'm going to hit the notes quite right, though. That's the problem. So, good. So if you have the weak decay, then you go to neutrinos. This is the rate. It's, you can compute it. And okay, it is of what size? But it scales as delta to the fifth over mz to the fourth. Okay. And this is the same effect of neutron to proton, you know, scaling, right? It's just kinematics. If you have a magnetic moment like interaction and you spit off the photon from that, then this is only delta cubed over some mass that is resulting in this effective interaction. So in the case of Higgsinos, this would be the chargino. Okay. Simple exercise to convince yourself that once delta is smaller than about a GeV, and under the assumption that these charged characters are not far off from what the neutral ones are, this one dominates. So you can even relax this assumption dramatically and you'll still have this dominating. Okay, so this is a case where you could upscatter through say weak exchange and you decay through the magnetic moment and you get a photon. Now the decay length. So when it's, now that we've convinced ourselves of this radiative decay that is proceeding, you can compute the length. Here it is in sort of numbers of relevance to us. So sort of 20 kilometers CV of order 400 kilometers per second, that's right in the middle of the plot that I was showing. Delta of say 400 keV, again, sort of in this plot, and the mass of the dark matter at a TeV, and the relative scalings of these quantities. So roughly speaking, we're talking between 10 to 1,000 kilometers.
Yeah, so it's in the crust, like that.
If it's 10, it's in the crust. If it's 1,000, it's not.
Uh-huh. But 20 kilometers would be, what is the thickness of crust?
It is 20, 30 kilometers,
uh-huh. Yeah,
typically. I mean, it varies a little bit as you go around, but yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So the point is, if it were much smaller than the depth of the crust, you would never care about these different abundances. If it was much larger than that, you may also not care because it would be probably dominated by the mantle. If it's right near that, then actually the differences in the elements can make a difference. You'll see an effect of that. If I have time, I'll tell you a very amusing effect of that near the end of the talk. All right, so 10,000 kilometers, that's the scale that we're talking about. So now we can sort of focus down on what's happening in this plot that I showed before. So dark matter comes in, it does its scatter. Now we know, right, it's scattering off lead. That's the dominant heavy element to do the inelastic scatter. The Chi-2 comes off and it travels a distance 10 to 1,000 kilometers and then decays and dominantly decays to a photon. So that's the setup, that's how it works. And then of course the dark matter just escapes.
Question.
Yep.
Do you care about the fact that the scattering is gonna go forward in the direction of flow and you're only going to see for, you know, 1 hour delay?
Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. And that is directionality. Yep. So, in fact, that is the key thing to this. And that's, I would say, the thing that makes this signal very, very interesting. So there is.
They have to tune the piano.
Oh, they have to tune. Oh, I see. Okay. All right.
There's the recital tomorrow. Do you guys
really? I see. If they don't tune today, it's a disaster tomorrow. Okay. Good. Well, as long as it doesn't bother you, it doesn't bother me. So there we go. So the dark matter wind is highly directional. This may or may not be intuitive to you. The simplest thing to think first is that, of course, we are moving in a dark matter wind. So in the lab frame, right, there's a wind of dark matter that is coming at us, and we happen to be moving in the direction toward, at least locally, right now, in our current time, and for the next some number of thousands or tens of thousands of years, we're heading toward a particular constellation.
You should call it just duck wind.
Duck wind, as you like. And that is Cygnus. Roughly the Cygnus constellation. So right now, Cygnus is directly above us. So right now, the dark matter wind is dominantly coming right down at us on our heads. Okay. If we had the ability to feel it, to sense it, that's what we would, you know, we would feel this rain of dark matter right now. Okay. The difference, the notion of this directionality is striking. It's striking at some level, depending on, and again, I should say this, it depends on how familiar you are with directional detection in the first place. If you were already familiar with it, then you sort of already know this intuitively. If, however, you were sort of in this direct detection game of not thinking about directionality, this notion of the highly directional nature of dark matter may or may not be sort of interesting. So even with no inelastic splitting, there is sort of a two order of magnitude difference between the flux of dark matter coming from Cygnus versus the flux coming from the opposite direction. And that's, again, just due to our relative motion in the dark matter wind. As you increase the inelasticity, 100 keV, 300, 550, this directionality becomes much more pronounced, to the point where if you take a very large delta close to the ability of any dark matter to scatter, then effectively dark matter wind acts almost like a gun that is just shooting it straight down at us. Okay, so it's highly directional as delta gets large.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused by the delta equals zero limit, because the wind in the direction of Cygnus I thought was like 230 kilometers per second, and the dispersion in our galaxy is 166. I mean, it's order one directional, yeah. But it's not two orders of magnitude directional. So what am I missing in the top left?
So,
is it two orders of magnitude worse in the opposite direction of Cygnus?
But it is precisely that you're on
the tail of the Maxwell-Boltzmann.
So it really is taking this distribution and boosting it.
Okay.
in one direction versus the other. And we don't normally think about this because direct detection experiments are not sensitive.
So you made some assumptions about E, like the threshold, the minimum energy threshold for your experiment too?
Sure, yeah.
Such that you're on the tail, right?
Not dramatically, right? Not dramatically. Because it really is boosting the F of V, mm-hmm. one direction versus the other.
Sure, but by order one, by 230 kilometers per second versus the 166 kilometers per second spread. So that's why I think if you had zero energy threshold, or I would think it's just an order one effect.
Now you're really pressing me on exactly how. Which flux was looked at? I'll have to check and just make sure. Yeah. Okay. Fine. Now, so what's the point of the directionality? Is that now you get a very large daily modulation because of the fact that the downgoing dark matter is only able to scatter off the rock that you have above the detector. So 1 kilometer or so, 1-2 kilometers for typical detectors that you would be interested in detecting photons. Whereas if it came from the opposite direction, of course you have the whole 6,400 kilometers, or the 1280, whatever, 10,000-ish kilometers of rock that you can scatter off of before you finally get here. Now, of course, you won't actually go through most of this. Any of the events that you excite here, given this decay length of 10 to 1,000 kilometers, will have already decayed by the time well before this detector. So instead, there's a cone of radius that sort of extends out around the detector that is where you're sensitive to. But this also shows that it actually is not particularly sensitive to what the decay length is, because as I increase the decay length, I increase the volume of the rock that is capable of scattering. And so it approximately cancels out.
What you showed, it is point of decay or point of interaction, because there is the point where this incoming particle interacts with your target, right?
Right.
And
so,
can you also K2?
Correct. So there's a band of the rock that is capable of interacting with and surviving all the way to the detector before it decays. Mm-hmm. That makes sense? Yeah. Which is this 10 to 1,000 kilometers. So then it goes to David's comment, which is that, as is sort of well known from astronomy, although it wasn't well known to all of us, the Earth provides a wonderful reference frame, a reference frame relative to fixed stars, which is the sidereal frame. And this is, of course, the notion that the Earth rotates once every 23 hours and 56 minutes relative to the fixed stars. So constellations appear at the same sidereal time. Same sidereal time, each sidereal day, which is basically the statement that our watches were all designed completely wrong. We should have been designed as actually having sidereal time, none of this solar thing. Okay, if we were really honest to God dark matter physicists, we should have. I even looked up what you can buy. We can go to Geneva and make a watch that has sidereal time. Anyway, That's a different story. So Cygnus, where dark matter is coming from, is a northern hemisphere constellation. Right, you know, right now it's straight above us. Its declination is 45 degrees north, which means that if you have a detector that is of a latitude 45 degrees north or above, then it's always above you. Okay? It's always above you, and you only have the overburden of the rock to scatter off of. Between 45 north and 45 south, it's partially above and partially below. And if you're below 45 south, then it's always set. So here's the motion of Cygnus's path around something that might be like, you know, a detector you might be interested in. Okay, so sort of our latitude, maybe a little bit north of our latitude, and it looks something like this. So for most of this day, Cygnus is above the constellation, and then for a few hours of the day, in the northern hemisphere, it's below the horizon, which means you have some slice of the rock to scatter off of. That means you'll get this very large sidereal daily modulation of the dark matter signal. Now we have to search for it. So we have the setup where dark matter is doing its scattering, you're getting the photons. Now we know the photons are coming with this huge sidereal daily modulation, and it will happen during the time that Cygnus is set relative to the horizon of the Earth. But we need detectors to be able to find these things, detectors sensitive to sort of hundreds of keV photons. I mean, up to 600 or so. So yeah, depending on what you're interested in. So now you can go down your list of detectors and see what they're capable of doing. First, dark matter detectors, of course, are great, right? Xenon 100, Lux, they have very low energy thresholds, keV or so, right? Which are precisely, they were designed for that. They're trying to measure nuclear recoil with keV energy, you know, that comes out. They also, for say Xenon 100, is at a sort of declination that is probably useful. Okay, that is, it's not above 45, it's a little bit below, so there's a little bit of time by which you're getting this large rate. Okay, so that's good. There are other detectors, though, and specifically neutrino detectors, which will, in the end, be actually much superior to Xenon 100 for looking for the photons. And this is basically because they're much, much larger. And they're so much larger that volume dominates your ability to get sensitivity to this. That's one piece to it. The second piece is, for some of these detectors, specifically Borax-Xeno, and presumably what will happen with Juno, which is being built in China, their radioactive backgrounds are exceptionally low, much lower than even Xeno 100 or Lux. Okay? So the low radioactive backgrounds combined with their large size actually makes them superior to using a direct detection experiment to look for photons. There are other possibilities, and depending on how much time I've got and how we go on this, I'll talk about Cygnus. I'll talk a few minutes about Cygnus, and I won't talk about a lot of these other ones because many of the other big detectors that are, you know, some operating and some at the stage of being built or planned are great for detecting neutrinos, but would be not useful for us because their energy threshold is too high, sort of MeV-ish. That's life. SNOW, my wonderful Canadian counterpart detector, probably would have been useful. It's certainly big, has sort of the right kind of materials to look for it. It's 46 degrees. Okay, Canada's too far north. So that's life. Okay, so let me talk about Borax-Xeno. So here's to give you some idea of the relative radioactive backgrounds of different experiments. Here's the sort of background rates for what Cogent found many, many years ago, sort of the DAMA rate, remembering that DAMA was never trying to reject background. They had a constant level of background, and they just saw an annual modulation on top of it and said, ha, dark matter. Anyway, Xenon 100, so this plot's a little old, but it gives you some idea. Few orders of magnitude below these rates. Okay, going up, Borax-Xeno. Okay, so it's 3-4 orders of magnitude below what the xenon experiments are able to do. Very, very radio pure. it had to be, because one of the points of Borak's Zeno was not to look for dark matter, even though it should have been. They were looking for neutrinos. Specifically, they wanted to look for the beryllium 7 neutrino flux from the sun.
But it is for recoil measurement, right? Not for measurement of Borak.
Correct. It is. That's right. Although this is, so this is electron equivalent energy, and so there is a conversion of you hit an electron and it converts into a certain amount of electron equivalent energy, but the photons do the same thing. You deposit a 100 keV photon and it effectively gives the same energy amount that comes out. There is a resolution to it, and it's sort of for the energies that we're talking about, it's typically 10%. Okay. All right. So Borak's Zeno's goal in life was to get the beryllium-7 neutrino flux, and that's this little edge right there. And the fact that it came down and went like that, right, that was their discovery, one of the discoveries. Here's that plot zoomed in. So here's the beryllium-7 line, the flux that you're trying to look for. Here's their total background, and you can see the data, okay? And the other lines are what they anticipate, or what they have sort of come to understand to be their dominant radioactive backgrounds. Here's a sort of a bigger list of them all. Krypton, bismuth, carbon-14 over here on this end. Let me just move over on this side. So you can see, so there's one funny background right in the middle here, this little hoop called polonium-210. There's a technique to remove that because that's dominantly alpha radiation. The rest of these are basically betas, and betas deposit electron equivalent energy. You can't reject. Carbon-14 is this massive background, and this is despite the fact that Borak's Zeno used a liquid scintillator involving carbon, that they used depleted carbon, so carbon taken deep out of the earth that had already had most of its carbon-14 decayed. Even with this depleted carbon, they still had a massive background here. So this, unfortunately, sets the limit to how well you can do in what the threshold is in energy. And then as a consequence, what your sensitivity will be in delta, in the inelastic splitting. So you're not going to be able to probe much below, say, 200 keV, precisely because this background is so large. Okay, so here's what the background looks like. It does this thing, and there's the measurement they got. So now we have a detector that's capable of measuring rates in this level of one count per day per 100 ton per keV window. And you need to take that and convolute this with this picture of dark matter comes in, it scatters, and off you. So there is a process of having to simulate dark matter wind from any direction, integrating over all possible directions. It comes into the Earth, scatters off elements. You have to treat the Earth in this way of having, and our way of treating it was three spherical shells of shell of the crust, the mantle, and the core. And then as the dark matter comes in, you have to track it, scatters, goes for a distance, decays, and simulate this, and then run this many times. And from there, try to determine what the predicted rate would be. You do that process, won't give you the details, just telling you the result. This is what it looks like. This is the rate specifically in the Borak's Zeno detector. The rate, these are rates now, these are raw rates, so rates per second, and Borak's Zeno being the number of tons that this is exposed to, for particular parameters. So in all of these cases, we just took one TeV for the dark matter mass, just something to work with, and then varied the inelastic splitting, and then used the radiative decay rate to compute its lifetime. Okay, so the lifetime is always directly related to the delta that we've chosen. And then from there, we get these rates. And what you observe, of course, is, no surprise, massive sidereal daily modulation. So like this. In fact, when we first plotted this, we plotted it not in sidereal time, but in solar hour time, which means that as you march around the months of the year, the place where the peak is shifts, precisely because of the sidereal shift. Okay. And no surprise, you can see a number of things here. So first, Yeah, the annual modulation that we're used to thinking about with inelastic dark matter is already here. This is the notion that the June 1st peak rate is higher than the December 1st peak rate. And so that difference, these differences is the annual modulation you're already seeing. But the huge modulation is the one that's every sidereal day. So that's great, because with this sidereal daily modulation, this is not something a radioactive decay does. It's not something atmospheric neutrinos do. Okay? It is a way to try to maximize your signal over background, because you have a way of accessing the signal different from how the background behaves. So you can do that, and there's probably great ways to actually do it. We did something very crude. All we did was to say, let's take the off time, the time when the signal is minimized, and consider that effectively a measurement of the background. And then during the on time, which is when the signal is high, you integrate over that, and then you set a bound, or you can at least get a sensitivity, which is the rate in the off time effectively divided by the square root of the exposure. So this effectively means that if the signal had been flat, then you would have measured the background well once, and then that would have been it. That would have been your bound. This way, the fact that you can actually take the sort of signal off to signal on time means you can improve as square root of n on the sensitivity as you integrate over more time. Oreksino's time was 1,400 days, roughly 10 years. Okay, so it's a good length of time that they did measurements. So then you take this information, and then you finally turn the crank to figure out what is the sensitivity in the delta cross-section plot. And this is it. Okay, so this is the main result of the talk and of the thing that I'm doing. And what we find is that in Oreksino in particular, so in a detector we already have, you can improve once you have an inelastic splitting above, say, 250 or so keV, and then extending out to sort of 600 or so keV. So you can probe regions of this cross-section parameter space with the photon signal that you can never probe with direct nuclear recoil in direct detection experiments. So that's cool. And the two curves are Oreksino and Juno. Juno, basically the difference between this and this is our prediction as to how well Juno would do, assuming they have similar background rates. Of course, they have to work to get it to there, but assuming they can do that. So this difference is largely the difference in the size of the detectors. There's actually a little additional enhancement due to Juno's presence at something like 30-odd degrees north rather than 43.
But experimentally, in terms of measurement, you're implying using the same data, how you see this photon, because I probably do not understand whether if they measure recoil,
They measure like electron equivalent energy, scintillation. It's just scintillation.
Scintillation, but it is for them the way to measure recoil or the way to measure photons or how you differentiate whether it's photons or not?
You can't. That's the point. You can't distinguish between photon deposition and electron or positron deposition. They actually have a little bit of distinction between positrons and electrons, but anyway, that's an aside. Mm-hmm. They can tell alphas that are different because they have a different, it looks different for them. But yeah, the electron and photons are the same. So that's why all of these radioactive decays mm-hmm. are backgrounds to us, because even though they don't emit photons, they emit electron equivalent energy.
But then you can say that you measure photons, right? I mean.
So what you have to do is to look for sidereal daily modulation.
So
right.
I have a question.
Yes.
How long do these photons live inside the satellite?
No. I mean, it's negligible. Yeah, it's very short. Because this is some liquid scintillator. Yeah, very short. I mean, you deposit a photon and or you kick an electron with the same energy. Basically, it does the same thing in the scintillator.
So, what are the prospects of doing? So they have to. Oreksino would have to do a reanalysis of their existing data.
Yes.
Sidereal.
Yes. Interestingly, they've done annual modulation analyses. Like they've looked for daily modulation, solar daily modulation, integrated over years. The problem is that if you integrate over years of solar daily, you wipe out the sidereal daily signal. So they could have a signal in their data. They just have to look for it.
So
they haven't done it yet.
Open to collaboration?
You know, we did have some contacts at some point, and it didn't seem to go anywhere. So I think we probably should do more to convince them to do this.
Should you convince one of them to take on a student?
Yes, of course, of course.
But I'm trying to collect in Dharma, they had modulation, but not daily modulation.
Precisely.
And you need daily modulation.
That's what they should look for, correct.
But can you exploit their data for daily modulations as well?
Well, they have the data and they have the timestamps, right, yeah. of all of this. So they could do it. They just have to decide
so
to do it.
So how many events would there be in this?
That depends on where you are in cross
section. How much is it? I mean, is it 100 events? I'd like to see how much it's expensive.
Yeah, for that, what you do is you go back to the background plot and you look at, you know, what is the likelihood of fluctuating above. And I think, you know, if it were far above, you probably would have seen something already. It's hard to know for sure, but that's sort of the, you know, the guess. But again, these background plots are integrated over time, right? They're not sliced by day. But yeah, as to the actual rates, I can get this number for you, but it's my memory is it's at the level of sort of hundreds.
Okay, so the standard is that
tens to hundreds, something like that. Integrated over the life of the detector, over 10
right.
years.
So if you're not looking for daily modulation, you will not see it, basically.
Yeah. Well, it could. If you're right here, yeah. If you're right at the edge of this cross section.
Yeah, because it's, you know, 100. It's not a big number.
It's not a big number. Okay. By the way, this is a small aside. So earlier this year, there was a paper by Maxim Pospelov, Surjit. And company, and they were looking for trying to probe inelastic dark matter at much larger recoil energies by doing what they called collisional de-excitation of nuclear isomers. So they specifically had in mind things like using hafnium for some amount and some amount of time, letting dark matter come in, and it de-excites the hafnium, giving off additional energy and thereby being able to probe even larger inelastic splittings. But what's amusing for our purpose is to sort of take their plot in their cross-section space and mass space and then superimpose the plot I just showed you, and this is what it is. So you can see this gray band was in fact exactly our band that they put on there. And then they're able to probe these much, much larger cross sections than what we're talking about. But they can go to much higher delta, whereas here you can see that obviously the photon signal is going to be dominating in this sort of range. There's more. If you put a detector in the southern hemisphere, there's an interesting new effect, which is there's two maxima for each sidereal day. Not one, like we were showing before. And that's an amusing thing. And the size of it depends, of course, on delta and details and so forth. Here, we're imagining, so this doesn't exist. There is no detector in the southern hemisphere. There's not even really a plan for one. There is a lab in the southern hemisphere. Okay, I'm not suggesting you go build one tomorrow. Let's find a signal in the northern hemisphere first, then we can go to the southern. It's fine. Okay. But this is where this issue of the crust versus mantle makes a difference.
I mean, why is there two maxima? Maybe this is obvious.
That's exactly what I'm telling you. Exactly what I'm going to say. It's the same reason that sunrise and sunset, there's two times that it's red. In the sense that one time of day, you imagine you take the Earth, slice it into a bowl-like thing, put your detector in the southern hemisphere, and you maximize the signal when you go through the maximum amount of crust. And so, and that happens two times a day, okay? Two times a day, and in well-defined sort of locations. And it's not split by 24 hours apart necessarily, because that depends on the latitude. So it's an amusement, and it's something that would happen there. It actually can also happen in the northern hemisphere in principle, but it just turns out that the northern hemisphere rates are such that you rarely see this. You're actually not able to resolve this difference. Okay, so there's nothing fundamentally different about southern hemisphere. It's just that that's where you can maximally see this effect. All right. There's still more. And so what I want to do is just say a few words about one other kind of way of trying to look for this, and then I'll wrap up. Okay. So the photon signal scales with the volume of the detector, not the mass. And therein is one way to try to think about different kinds of detector technology that would maximally be sensitive to this signal. The ideal detector would be large volume and low mass, which is, of course, precisely what gas scintillation does. Gas scintillation detectors are what are used for directional detection of dark matter. Now, I have to be clear about something. This is the standard dark matter elastic scattering trying to look for directional information and using that as to separate it. We are going to use directional detectors to look for the photon signal that itself has a large directional component to it, but it has nothing to do with the directional nature of what the detector is doing. There are various versions of this. So one of them was drift. It operated for a while. It was about a meter cubed. Cygnus is this sort of amorphous proposal by several different groups around the world. I still have not yet wrapped my mind around this completely, but there are essentially several different technology designs for making this go. And different designs have, because of the nature of what they're trying to do, to look for this scintillation signal, different designs are either have more or less radioactivity associated with their components inside the detector. And that's, of course, bad for us, because radioactivity means a higher signal, and so you have to, right, you have to somehow use the cellular daily modulation to exploit that. But they at least have possibilities where they can use gases that don't necessarily have any radioactive background, like helium. So this is some slides from Neil Spooner in IDM 2018, and at least they are claiming that they can go to volumes between 10 to 1,000 meter cubed. Okay, but only 1 meter cubed has ever been done so far. So the advantages of this is there's negligible neutrino backgrounds because it's gas and it's helium. Okay. No. There's a much lower threshold that you can go to, sort of 1 keV. Or so. And the reason for the low threshold is you don't have carbon. You don't have carbon-14. You don't have to deal with those backgrounds. It's at least in principle scalable to large volume. That's what Neil Spooner and their collaborators are telling us. So it at least suggests that this is a way you could then use more common elements that are lighter, and you could use those to do upscattering. So you sort of go back to this plot and you can see, well, yeah, so lead works and it does its fine thing for Borax-Eno, but now you have the possibility to go to, say, silicon or oxygen or other elements down here, which are much more abundant and therefore potentially give you better sensitivity. Here's what we think you can do. So this is, again, with this assumption of you scatter with some cross-section that's, you know, the chi 1 to chi 2 excitation off the nucleus with a effective cross section that's here. And what we find is that Cygnus, while it's not particularly sensitive in the region where you're only scattering off of lead, so the bounds are way up here, whereas, you know, Borax-Eno's signal is there, they can actually improve, they can do much better at lower delta. Ordinarily, you would say, well, why do lower delta? Because, of course, you know, you already have nuclear recoil bounds from that. But you can do potentially even better than ordinary nuclear recoil, essentially because you have much more rock to scatter off of. And if you can be sensitive to the photon signal, you're going to do better than just having, you know, 1 meter cubed of xenon. Okay. How much better depends on how big the detector is and what the radioactive backgrounds are in the experiment. So we did four projections. So here's 1 meter, 10, and 1,000 meters, and these assumed a background rate that we extracted from these slides, from these proposals. Just for fun, we also plotted what would happen if you had zero background. Now, there's no detector that's going to have zero backgrounds. You're never going to actually get to here. But it at least gives you the idea of if you are able to reduce the background rates due to the impurities of the elements of stuff that you put in the detector, how much better you could try.
Do the backgrounds come from the gas or they come from the walls?
They actually come from planes of charge that they have to put in so that they can do the drift and they can see this directionality. So it actually has to do with the design of the detectors itself. And it's the stuff you put in that's the problem. Yeah, exactly. So that's pretty cool. Let me just say so once you get to this point, then you can begin going back and analyzing other possibilities, like this was assuming that you scatter basically like a Higgs-like exchange, okay, or Z exchange, something like that. Now you could go back and do this with magnetic inelastic. This operator, go off and do it. If you do this, what's amusing about this is, you can sort of see it from this plot. So these were the bounds on the effective coefficient of this magnetic inelastic interaction, assuming you normalized it by the mass of the dark matter. And you can see that, so for one TeV dark matter, here's the bound that you get from Pico, here's the bound from xenon. You notice they're not far away in GM space, and that's because Pico involves, this is the Pico using iodine. Iodine has a very high spin. The high spin means that it's sensitive to the magnetic operators that this thing induces. And that sensitivity means also then that you're interested in elements that have high effective spin. Iodine's one of them, but it's not very abundant in the Earth. Instead, I want to get this out. But instead, you can go back to the Earth and look at all the elements, and then basically go through this table and figure out who has a high abundance that also has a high effective spin. And there, of course, you discover that it's actually aluminum is the best, because aluminum is mostly aluminum 27. It has a high spin. So aluminum, and it's relatively abundant. Go over here and see aluminum is sitting just close to silicon. So this suggests to us that we will be able to get an even better sensitivity to magnetic inelastic using the photon signal in these large gaseous detectors. What the bound is, you have to stay tuned. We don't have it yet, but we're working on it. Okay, now I'll take the question.
No, I just started to follow that.
Yeah.
In this way, elements of the Earth, not elements of your detector.
Correct. Oh, that's right. Yeah. This is all elements of the Earth that we're interested in. Okay. Yeah. To scatter off the rock and then. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, of course, if you do this, if you play this game, you're at much smaller deltas. Smaller deltas mean the decay length scaled as delta cubed. So now you've got decay lengths that are going almost to the full sort of the size of the Earth or longer. Okay. So now you're actually exploiting the entire Earth to actually give up scatter. Okay, that's it. WIMPs that scatter inelastically, viable, well-motivated, provide new means. There are new ways to search for it. The photon signal is great from this excited state decay. Borg-Sino already has sensitivity sort of in this range, and if they were to analyze their data, they could try to find it. It is sensitivity and not a bound because they haven't searched for this. And then these large gaseous detectors like Cygnus could see a vast improvement and go to much lower inelasticities and have sensitivity that is considerably better, we think, than what you can do with even just direct detection. That's it, thanks.
There's been a lot of questions for Graham, but if there's some more, we can explore.
Shut me up.
Yeah.
For inelastic dark matter, is there any competition from telescopes looking for gamma ray lines from like the moon or something?
Yeah, we looked at that and the rates seem to be too small. Yeah, so I don't want to say it's impossible. We have not exhausted all possibilities, but we thought about this idea of looking sort of at stars and, could you see a gamma ray line? Sort of, yeah, that it looks to us that the rates are just too small, at least once you look at these bounds that we're seeing. Maybe if you go to even larger inelastic splittings, like above 600 keV, then the rates could be high enough, but we didn't probe that.
A was going to ask a similar question. There's limits on just background light, right, from decaying dark matter that's decaying slower than, at, you know, with rates slower than Hubble. But here you have, here it's not the decay rate, but here it would be like the n sigma v on baryons, let's say. What if n sigma v was 10 to the minus 10 Hubble? Like that I think you would still be able to see.
Sorry, so
I think dark matter decaying at a rate of 10 to the minus 10 Hubble is sort of the hundreds of keV range. I think that is excluded.
This is, but remember, this is decaying, this is the dark matter completely decaying down.
Sure, yes. Yeah.
And that's,
and
what you're really doing is integrating over the whole universe when you do that, like the whole history of the universe.
Yes.
Yeah. The decay times here we're talking about are like fractions of a second.
Sure, but I'm saying, here the n sigma, so the rate of production of photons would be n sigma v,
yeah.
Right? And so is,
you still want, you want to scatter off something else and then see the photons.
Sure.
Yeah, we think the rates are
good. Like what Seth was saying, but then not the moon, but just clusters.
Why is scatter of baryons as opposed to just the fact that there's a whole bunch of X-ray sources that produce tons of photons?
Yeah, but the point is that you scatter out gas. I mean, all sorts of things you scatter out. Even if the rates go low with its hydrogen, you still have a small fraction of the excited population, then you'll decay and you'll get monochromatic. So you should see
a haze.
Even in places where there's no stars.
Dark matter things, you would see the monochromatic signal.
For at least the deltas that we were probing, sort of south of 600, we think the rates are too small. Once you take this cross section,
because there's few heavy elements.
The density is sufficiently low, and then if you convolute that with the actual background gamma function,
small enough deltas, right? Then you get very light elements that are present.
Right, but now the cross section, the bounds are now at the level of, you know, per nucleon are now at 10 to the minus 40.
Oh, that's also the natural 5 thing where you just take a photon, hit it, and then it gets excited and then decays again. Are there background photons that
Oh, you mean you mean to excite the dark matter with background photons?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean in principle that can happen too, but then
Right, because you excite them, and then you should have the luminous source and then a halo around.
Then you need the relative. There's a few things. So one thing is, what is the flux of the photons that you have in the range necessary to actually do the excitation relative to, you know, doing the scattering off of baryons, the abundance of baryons. That's a small flux because we're talking about, you know, keV to hundreds of keV. I mean, at the very low end of a few keV, yes, the sun's emitting a good amount of them, but once you get to 10 or above, it's not much. There's not much.
Well, I'm thinking black holes.
Yeah.
Right, black holes would be the accretion that produces a ton of X-rays.
Right, but that's for this to work, you need it to be a dark, an otherwise optically uninteresting region, whereas in black, it's a very optically interesting region. Right?
Yeah.
But it will be the halo around the check.
Yeah. What about this inverse process, for example, when this excited states hits the target, would it be, you know, influence, I mean, then it could, I believe, have a larger, equal or whatever. Because if you have enough of these events, then maybe, you know, it would be...
You're right. You want to take chi 2 and hit a nucleus.
Yeah, and then you produce, this chi 1.
Yeah, so that rate is down by the flux that you have of chi 2s to begin with. Basically there's just so many more chi 1s available to do the upscatter that you're going to get the best bound from that.
I guess the answer is you also never get sufficiently energetic flux. So let's say you had a dwarf galaxy that was backlit by some very energetic source.
Could you see a dark line? Yeah, that's also a good question. I think the rates are too small, but okay.
Yeah, you have to have a very
It's in principle, there's, it's worth actually doing, carrying out beyond the back of the envelope, which is the extent to which I've done.
Okay, Sandra, I'm again.